thank you very much. When he put the microphone on me, he wanted to know if I walked around or was I stable. Yeah. Well, I like to think both. Matter of fact, that sounds like one of those questions you hear on Meet the Press. Although, in complete honesty, I've had moments when I was walking around and indeed crawling and was not very stable. Not lately, though. I appreciate the invitation to speak here today. It's always nice not to be in Washington. John Kenneth Galbraith said that nearly all our political comment originates in Washington, where politicians, after talking things over with each other, relay misinformation to Washington journalists, who after further intramural discussion print it where it is thoughtfully read by the same politician. This, said Dr. Galbraith, is the only successful closed system for the recycling of garbage that has yet been devised. There are many of us at the Washington Times newspaper who are trying to change that. That's the new paper in Washington. We desperately need your support, because without it, we are going to fail. We are not going to continue to remain in existence. The newspaper is available by mail, and if any of you want to talk to me later about how to get it, you can ask me. Or you can write the paper in Washington, D.C., just Washington Times Circulation Department, find out how to get a mail subscription. I will also be a regular contributor to the Chalcedon Report starting soon. Where else but in Washington, D.C. could the National Center for Productivity go out of business after a General Accounting Office report found it to be insufficiently productive? Washington has been described as a place where a foreign visitor could see the House of Representatives in action, describe it as a place where a man gets up to speak, he says nothing, nobody listens, and when he's through, everyone disagrees. No wonder the former Senate chaplain, and believe me, things have not changed, Edward Everett Hale said, when asked if he prayed for the senators, replied, no, that he looked at our senators and prayed for the country. In a recent interview this month in U.S. News and World Report magazine, Don Hewitt, the executive producer of the CBS News program 60 Minutes, was asked this question. Mr. Hewitt, does network news have a liberal bias? Mr. Hewitt, I would suggest that critics try that out on Geraldine Ferraro. If we had the liberal bias Jesse Helms says we have, and we were as influential as he says we are, how did Ronald Reagan end up in the White House? Why aren't Mondale and Ferraro in the White House? When asked, what about studies that show journalists are liberal in the way they vote? Mr. Hewitt says, I've never seen any evidence of that. When asked, isn't there a need for television to give people more opportunity to respond to programs? He does grudgingly concede, and I quote, that's the one place we fall down badly. Now, if Mr. Hewitt were Pinocchio, his nose would be roughly the size of the Washington Monument. Notice that when asked, does the network have a bias, he responds in terms of the network's powerlessness. Not the same thing, is it? I happen to believe that the media, while more biased than ever, is losing its power. But they're not the same thing. And Mr. Hewitt knows it. Now, it's interesting that this question about studies that show journalists are liberal the way they vote, Mr. Hewitt says, I've never seen any evidence of that. Now, this is interesting because Mr. Hewitt is executive director of the most watched program on television. It's probably the program with the most number of researchers, reporters, staffers. 60 Minutes appears to have the ability to find anybody, anywhere, anytime with a camera and a microphone, but gee, Mr. Hewitt just can't seem to find the evidence about how journalists vote. Why he hasn't simply asked them, he doesn't tell us. In 1981, the piece in Public Opinion magazine, which I have to believe Mr. Hewitt knows about, Mr. S. Robert Lichter and Stanley Rothman detailed at length the views of what they call the new media elite. The article was based on hour-long interviews with 240 journalists and broadcasters at the most influential media outlets, both print and television. And here are some of the things that Lichter and Rothman discovered. Again, a brilliant idea. Just go out and ask people what they believe. Perhaps Mr. Hewitt will now think of it. They discovered this in 1981. And I think things are worse now. Ideologically, a majority of these leading journalists described themselves as liberals. 54% said they were left of center, compared to only 19% who chose the right side of the spectrum. Of those who say they voted, these leading journalists voted for Carter over Ford for president in 1976 by a margin of 81 to 19%. For McGovern over Nixon in 1972 by a margin of 81 to 19%. For Humphrey over Nixon in 68 and for Johnson over Goldwater in 64. These interviews were conducted before the 1980 election. Now, this, of course, will come as a shock, but the media elite picked themselves as the group most favored to direct American society. Lichter and Rothman say that this is somewhat ironic, since the press is traditionally ambivalent about its power, and journalists often either deny or decry the growing reality of a powerful media elite. Geographically, the media elite are drawn primarily from northern industrial states, especially from the Northeast Corridor. Only 3% are drawn from the entire Pacific Coast. I hasten to add, I'm not at all certain that's bad. A predominant characteristic of the media elite is its secular outlook. Exactly 50% eschew any religious affiliation. Only 8% go to church or synagogue weekly, and 86% seldom or never attend formal religious services. Leading journalists emerged from the survey as strong supporters of affirmative action, women's rights, so-called, homosexual rights, and sexual freedom, so-called, in general. 90% agree that a woman has the right to decide for herself when to have an abortion. 75% see nothing wrong with homosexuality. 85% uphold the right of a homosexual, so-called, to teach in public schools. And 54% do not regard adultery as wrong. The media elite show a strong preference for welfare capitalism, pressing for assistance to the poor in the form of income redistribution and guaranteed employment. 68% agree that the government should substantially reduce the income gap between the rich and the poor. And in most instances, majorities of the media elite voice the same criticisms that are raised in the third world. 56% say American economic exploitation has contributed to third world poverty, and almost the same percentage believe that America's heavy use of natural resources is, quote, immoral. The media elite is well educated and well paid. 93% have college degrees, 55% attended graduate school as well. In 1978, 78% earned at least $30,000 a year and had salaries that exceeded $50,000. One in three had salaries that exceeded $50,000. Nearly half reported family incomes over $50,000. Anyone who believes that the views of the media elite do not have anything to do with their reporting probably also believes in the Easter Bunny, the Tooth Fairy, and Santa Claus, and I hasten to add, not necessarily in that order. Barbara Walters, Time Magazine, December 1983, says, quote, "The news media in general are liberal. If you want to be a reporter, you're going to have to see poverty and misery, and you have to be involved in the human condition." In June of 1973, in the Quill magazine, published by Sigma Delta Chi, Walter Cronkite, and I'll have more to say about Uncle Walter later, said that most newspaper men, by definition, had to be liberal, otherwise they couldn't be good newspaper men. Sounds unassailable to me, doesn't it? And that's the way it is. In an appearance in March of this year before the Washington Ad Club, Washington Post chairman of the board, Katherine Graham, delivered an address titled, "Why People Dislike the Press." And in this address, she accurately noted that, and I quote, "Today, people are more angry with the press than ever." When I asked her about this Lichter-Rothman study, she said this study doesn't have much meaning, which, of course, meant it has too much meaning and I don't want to talk about it. She said that what matters is how people report the news. Again, the idea that one's views have, of course, nothing to do with the way one sees things. Arthur Kroc, who was 60 years in journalism, former bureau chief of the New York Times, relatively conservative, in his book, Consent of the Governed and Other Deceits, said that it is largely in the executive offices of the printed press and the network that slanting the news and its editorial evaluation is to be found. Important in the process are, he said, the placement of the news by which it can be minimized or magnified, and holding back news stories called keepers for publication on a date when they will have stronger impact in forming public opinion aligned with the editorial policy of the newspaper concerned. In April of 1982, at the White House, Larry Speech presented several former presidential press spokesmen to the assembled White House press corps in the briefing room. And for the most part, this was a light social affair where reporters got an opportunity to say hi to press secretaries they had worked for in days gone by. But one former press secretary had something substantive to say. His name is Roger Tubby. He used to be a journalist, and he was also President Truman's press spokesman. And he had some prepared remarks, and it was quite stunning. So I think Larry didn't expect it, and certainly the people in the press room didn't expect it. He was kind of nervous when it came time for him to speak, because he had something to say. He talked about how stories today in the press seem to be more heavily slanted than there used to be. From Fidel Castro's rise to power to El Salvador to the Palestine Liberation Organization, Mr. Tubby said that there is a definite tilt to the left in the media's coverage of these subjects. Mr. Tubby said, So many of our newspaper people and TV people, maybe out of idealism, seem to be over and over again partial to those who espouse the left-wing causes, and thus guerrillas are romanticized. Well, by now it was starting to get kind of quiet in the press room. Corks were being put back into champagne bottles. Referring to the then recently concluded elections in El Salvador, Mr. Tubby said, "Few viewers of TV or readers of our leading newspapers were prepared for the dramatic record of 1.4 million voters turning out to vote, and few of us were aware from watching TV or reading our newspapers that there would be, that this would be the case. We've had our attention focused for weeks on guerrilla activity," said Mr. Tubby, "and successes or impending successes by the guerrillas. No wonder," he said, "hundreds of voters shouted, 'Tell the truth,' as the U.S. media drove by them as they waited in line to vote." We should arrange an interview of Mr. Tubby by Mr. Hewitt, although I don't think you'll see Mr. Tubby soon on 60 Minutes. I think the modern problem of journalistic bias and dishonesty began with Watergate, so-called, a little over a decade ago. And it showed that activities, when engaged in by some people, seemed to attract more attention than when they were previously engaged in. This was pointed out in a book by Victor Lasky called It Didn't Start with Watergate. And he pointed out some of the following things. In May of 1973, at the height of the controversy over Watergate, columnist Bob Considine asked John Roosevelt, FDR's youngest son, what he thought about the Watergate scandal. He replied, "I can't understand all the commotion in this case. Hell, my father just about invented bugging. Had them spread all over and thought nothing of it." Lasky quotes a former high FBI official, William Sullivan, as saying, "Such a very great man as Franklin Roosevelt saw nothing wrong in asking the FBI to investigate those opposing his lend-lease policy, a purely political request. He also had us look into the activities of others who opposed our entrance into World War II, just as later administrations had the FBI look into those opposing the conflict in Vietnam." Harry Truman. When Mr. Truman became president in 1945, his military aide, Brigadier General Harry Vaughan, began receiving FBI transcripts of the wiretaps on FDR's aides. Angered by the trivia the taps were picking up, Truman ordered the FBI to stop the bugging, according to Mr. Vaughan. But the tap on one FDR aide was not cut off, says Mr. Lasky, for the activities of this individual reportedly chagrined Truman on the grounds that they might interfere with the proper administration of government. The Senate Intelligence Committee, who investigated this, reported that more than 175 reports were overheard on this wiretap, which continued until 1948, and they were delivered to the Truman White House. Mr. Lasky says, as the French say, the more things change, the more they remain the same. John F. Kennedy. Mr. Lasky says that the ultimate dirty trick, far more consequential than anything that was said to have occurred in Watergate, was the stealing of the 1960 presidential election from Nixon by Kennedy and his backers. In great detail, Mr. Lasky tells how this theft was pulled off and how it was Nixon who stopped any investigation of it because he didn't want to precipitate a constitutional crisis. Lasky also tells how JFK used the Internal Revenue Service to harass his political opponents, how he attempted to use the Federal Communications Commission to intimidate TV networks, and how the president's brother Bobby had the press bugged. Lasky quotes from a little publicized book titled Cheese Box, written in 1974 by Gerard Callahan, a mafia wire man, so-called, someone who taps wires. Once described, Mr. Callahan was, by the district attorney of Queens County, New York, as a notorious criminal, highly publicized as the electronics expert of the underworld. After Bobby Kennedy became attorney general, he called Callahan, whom he had known for years. Really, I don't know which of them to feel sorry for. To ask him to perform a wire job so secret and sensitive that it could not be entrusted to the FBI. This wire job was to tap the 20 or 30 phones of the conference room where the press would be working during JFK's upcoming visit to Newport, Rhode Island. This was done, and Callahan says that for this job he was given a substantial down payment by RFK to cover the costs of the equipment and expenses. Mr. Lasky quotes Washington Post executive editor Benjamin Bradley, a close personal friend of John F. Kennedy's, as telling him, Lasky, about the Kennedys. My God, they wiretapped practically everybody in this town. Lasky says that Mr. Bradley himself is convinced that when he, Mr. Bradley, was a reporter for Newsweek, President Kennedy had him bugged too. 1964 and 1968, Lyndon Johnson really went overboard in violating all the rules, says Mr. Lasky, by ordering the FBI to set up a special squad to be used personally by him at the Democratic National Convention. Ex-FBI man Mr. Sullivan says, the cover would be that it was a security squad to be used against the militants. Nothing had ever been done before or since to my memory. This squad was, of course, used to electronically bug certain prominent black civil rights activists, so-called, which brings us to Martin Luther King. Mr. Lasky says that Lyndon Johnson not only read the accounts of wiretaps that were put on Mr. King, which an aide described as being like an erotic book, but he also played the tapes for his friends. Mr. Lasky does not believe that two wrongs make a right, but in his book, he says that in law and politics, two wrongs can make a respectable precedent, if not a respectable president. But you see, the news media are not bound by the same laws, morals, or ethics that you and I are. There is a double standard. Bob Woodward, Carl Bernstein were the reporters who wrote the book All the President's Men. A movie was made about it, the story of their role in breaking the Watergate story. But in this book, and I saw this mentioned in none of the reviews, they admit themselves that in their zeal to get this story, they were not above pulling what they admitted were a few dirty tricks of their own. Mr. Bernstein admits that he used a phone company's source to breach the confidentiality of one of the Watergate burglars' telephone records, something he says would be an outrage were it done to him. He also confesses to using a Pentagon source to provide another person, in exchange for Watergate information, material from a third person's military medical records. The information requested was anything derogatory, such as arrests, mental illness, or history of homosexuality. I guess we should be heartened by the fact that Mr. Bernstein thought that was derogatory. As it turned out, this data was not needed. But clearly the dirtiest of the dirty tricks pulled were the efforts of the two reporters to pump Watergate grand jurors for information. As they tell it in their book, the effort began with an attempt on the part of Bernstein to first find out who the grand jurors were. And when Watergate chief prosecutor Earl Silbert refused to tell him, to provide a list, then he and Mr. Woodward then went down to the clerk's office at the courthouse and began nosing around. There he found the list of jurors. Told by a clerk that he would not be allowed to copy anything, no names, no notes. Woodward memorized the names and data about each, then went to a nearby men's room where he wrote the information down in his notebook. Back at the Post, there were doubts about such a, quote, seedy venture, as they now refer to it, of questioning jurors. Meeting in the office of executive editor Benjamin Bradley, described as desperate for a story, the two reporters with other editors eliminated nearly half the jurors. They were looking for what the two authors called the few least likely to inform the prosecutors of a visit. The paper's Metropolitan editor, Harry Roosevelt, is said to have worried about the mechanics of the reporters not getting caught. Finally, Bradley gave the go-ahead. Over that weekend, in December of 1972, Woodward and Bernstein conducted what they called their clumsy charade of questioning jurors about Watergate, but not the grand jury proceedings unless the juror mentioned it. On Monday morning, Bradley called them into his office saying, "The balloon is up." A juror had told the prosecutors of the questioning. The prosecutors had gone to U.S. District Judge John Sirica and Post Attorney Edward Bennett Williams. John Sirica is in some kind of bleep at you fellas, Williams told the two reporters. We had to do a lot of convincing to keep your out of jail. Judge Sirica requested Woodward and Bernstein to be in court at 10 a.m. on December 19th. With the grand jury present, he recounted the facts. The jurors had been approached for information, but none was disclosed. However, such an attempt was, at least potentially, a contemptuous offense, he said, reminding all present that grand jury deliberations are sacred and secret. The whole thing he characterized as extremely serious. Much to the relief of the two reporters, Judge Sirica, in a mini cover-up of his own, never named them, referring to the subverter of the sanctity of the proceedings only as, quote, a news media representative. When asked by their press colleagues who they thought this media person was, because this did become public, that there'd been an attempt to tamper with the grand jury to gain information, Judge Sirica said publicly only that it was a news media representative. So when Woodward and Bernstein come out, their colleagues are speculating along with them, wondering, gee, Bob, Carl, who do you think this is? When asked by their press colleagues who they thought this media person was, Woodward and Bernstein declined to speculate, they write. They tell us that during a rush to the hall, they decided that only as a last resort would they stonewall a direct question and deny outright it was them. In other words, they had already agreed to lie. They thought they could get by with indignation and artful footwork, as they put it, and they did. Describing their approaches to the grand jury, the two reporters say they did not break the law, but they had, in their words, sailed around it. They quote, and this is their phraseology, had chosen expediency over principle, and caught in the act, their role had been covered up. They had dodged, evaded, misrepresented, suggested, and even intimidated, even if they had not lied outright, they say. These are the people writing about Nixon. The more you know the press, the more people you meet in it, the more you understand why there's so little trust in the news media. One of the hidden premises in the arguments against the administration's restrictions on press coverage of the liberation of Grenada was the idea that every member of the press corps is always more honest and trustworthy than any member of the government. I don't think so. Although sometimes it's close. Not long ago at the Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism, this topic was examined: national security and freedom of the press. In his remarks to this seminar, Lyle Denniston, Supreme Court reporter for the Baltimore Sun, said that he doesn't mind being used at all by someone who has committed a crime, quote, if I can get a story out of it. Declaring that as a journalist, he has only one responsibility, and that is to get a story and print it. Mr. Denniston says, when asked if he would steal a document himself, I would. When asked if there are any limits to the extent to which he would be justified in his single-minded motivation, Denniston says, quote, mayhem might well be ruled out, but I'm not even sure of that. Would he break and enter? Mr. Denniston says, when asked if he would steal a document himself, I would. When asked if there are any limits to the extent to which he would be justified in his single-minded motivation, Denniston says, quote, mayhem might well be ruled out, but I'm not even sure of that. Would he break and enter? Denniston, breaking and entering is benign. No problem? Denniston, no problem whatever. Is he serious? Denniston, it isn't a question of justification in terms of the law. It's a question of justifying it in terms of the commercial sale of information to interested customers. That's my only business, says Denniston. That's the only thing I do in life, is to sell information, hopefully for a profit. Los Angeles Times Washington Bureau Chief Jack Nelson, at this same seminar, says that he would be a little bit concerned about dealing in stolen documents, quote, but in the end, it wouldn't make any difference. Britt Hume of ABC News, also at this seminar, says that he believes basically in being a little pregnant. Although I wouldn't trust him. Dan Rather, also at this seminar, says that as a professional, that's what he calls himself, my job is to publish and be damned. Come to think of it, I think that's what he does. He puts it out there and we damn it. Mr. Rathers asks, does it matter if what he is publishing comes with a taint of criminality about it? Mr. Rathers, some, but frankly, not a great deal. This is not a man plagued by conscience. Would it make a difference, he is asked, if a judge issued a 48-hour restraining order prohibiting him from publishing something? Rather, it wouldn't to me, but in honesty, that wouldn't be my decision to make. That's what he said. What he did is not his decision to make. But this is too much, even for Van Gordon Souter, president of CBS News, also at the seminar, and who also knows that it's being taped. He says he would have grave reservations about defying such an order, adding, I don't think that there is any way you can operate in the broadcast business as it's constituted today and violate that. No, meaning a judge's restraining order. There were some that will say that what Mr. Denniston said is exception rather than the rule, but I think that what separates Mr. Denniston from the other journalists is that he was exceptionally honest about what he said and said it on the record, and indeed represents the feelings of many more people who wouldn't dare say such things on the record into the microphone. You know, one thing you hear often is this quotation from Thomas Jefferson that if given a choice between a government without newspapers and newspapers without government, he would readily choose the latter option. One hears this frequently from members of the press. Well, Mr. Jefferson did indeed say this. In fact, he said many silly things. And, of course, as I always can't wait to point out, Mr. Jefferson, whatever else you think about him, never read the New York Times or the Washington Post or saw Dan Rather or any of the other two television networks. So maybe that explains a lot about why he felt this way. But there's some things Mr. Jefferson said about the press that these fellas don't tell you about. So I went and looked it up. In 1803, in a letter, he said, "Indeed, the abuses of the freedom of the press here have been carried to a length never before known or borne by any civilized nation." In his second inaugural address in March of 1805, Mr. Jefferson declared, "The artillery of the press has been leveled against us, charged with whatsoever its licentiousness could devise or dare. These abuses of an institution so important to freedom and science are deeply to be regretted, inasmuch as they tend to lessen its usefulness and to sap its safety. They might indeed have been corrected by the wholesome punishment reserved and provided by the laws of the several states against falsehood and defamation. But public duties more urgent press on the time of public servants, and the offenders have therefore been left to find their punishment in the public indignation." Well, obviously, back then, there were clearly more important things for public servants to do than put members of the press in jail. I'm not sure that is still the occasion. Referring to the outrages and the false facts conveyed by the press, still in his second inaugural address, Mr. Jefferson observed, "No inference is here intended that the laws provided by the state against false and defamatory publications should not be enforced. He who has the time renders a service to public morals and public tranquility in reforming these abuses by the salutary coercions of the law." In an 1807 letter, Mr. Jefferson said, "It is a melancholy truth that a suppression of the press could not more completely deprive the nation of its benefits than is done by its abandoned prostitution to falsehood. Nothing can now be believed which is seen in a newspaper. Truth itself becomes suspicious by being put into that polluted vehicle." I wonder how I would have reacted to television. "The real extent of this state of misinformation," he said, "is known only to those who are in situations to confront facts within their knowledge with the lies of the day. I will add," said Mr. Jefferson, "that the man who never looks into a newspaper is better informed than he who reads them, inasmuch as he who knows nothing is nearer to truth than he whose mind is filled with falsehood and errors." Perhaps an editor, he said, might begin a reformation in some such way as this. He might divide his paper into four chapters, heading the first truths, second probabilities, third possibilities, fourth lies. The first chapter would be very short. In an 1808 letter, he said, "The papers have lately advanced in boldness and flitigiousness." Flitigiousness sounds bad to me. "Beyond even themselves. I admit that restraining the press to truth, as present laws do, is the only way of making it useful." 1813, he said, "The newspapers of our country, by their abandoned spirit of falsehood, have more effectually destroyed the ability and utility of the press than all the shackles devised by Bonaparte." And finally, in an 1814 letter, he declared, "I deplore the putrid state into which our newspapers have passed, and the malignity, the vulgarity, and the mendacious spirit of those who write them. These ordures are rapidly depraving the public taste." I don't think Mr. Jefferson would be on the side of the press today. Some of the people you see in the press and their contacts are very strange indeed. NBC News, a few months ago, put out a guide titled "Central America in Turmoil." It was offered on the NBC Nightly News. At that time, I was told it had been mailed to almost 200,000 people across the country. One of the researchers on this publication is a woman named Nicole Schultz, S-Z-U-L-C. In an interview, she told me that she did a little of everything on this guide, including research on getting a lot of statistics together and putting them in story form. Furthermore, she said that she does field research and all research for Latin America for NBC News. This is not someone's name you see roll on the credits at the end of the news, by the way. Now, who is this woman? Well, I found out that she did research for one Mr. Philip Agee, who's written a series of books revealing the names of CIA agents. He is a former CIA agent himself and is thought by many to be a traitor. When I asked Ms. Schultz at the time she worked for Mr. Agee if she felt he was doing a good job that needed to be done, she said, yeah, that she did. Well, just exactly what were the jobs Mr. Agee was engaged in that she thought were good jobs and needed at the time to be done? In a 1974 news conference in London, Philip Agee announced a campaign to expose CIA officers and agents and to take the measures necessary to drive them out of the countries where they were operating and to seek within the U.S. to have the CIA abolished. In a series of actions from 1974 to 1978, and in two books published during this period, Mr. Agee identified hundreds of persons as CIA personnel. In July of 74, 2 days after a Jamaica press conference at which Mr. Agee's principal collaborator identified Richard Kinnaman as the CIA chief of station in that country, Mr. Kinnaman's house was hit by automatic weapons gunfire. And in January of 81, two American officials of the American Institute for Free Labor Development, previously identified as a CIA front by Mr. Agee, they were assassinated in El Salvador. In addition, government affidavits show that Mr. Agee made contact with the terrorists who held our hostages in Iran, urged them to demand certain CIA documents, and he offered to travel to Iran to analyze these documents for those who held our people captive. Also, the CIA Deputy Director for Operations has sworn that Mr. Agee's exposure of CIA personnel has prejudiced the ability of the United States to obtain intelligence. And finally, in a 1981 ruling upholding the Secretary of State's revoking Mr. Agee's passport because his activities, quote, are causing or are likely to cause serious damage to the national security or the foreign policy of the United States, unquote, a majority of the Supreme Court ruled as follows on this revocation of passport. Not only has Agee jeopardized the security of the United States, but he has endangered the interests of countries other than the United States, thereby creating serious problems for American foreign relations and foreign policy. Restricting Agee's foreign travel, said the court, the majority, although perhaps not certain to prevent all of Agee's harmful activities, is the only avenue open to the government to limit these activities. Nicole Schultz. Remember the name. She does the research for all the reports on Latin America you see on the NBC Nightly News. And you see some strange reports on the NBC Nightly News. On April 19th of this year, Robin Lloyd, State Department correspondent, in one of his reports, noted that the State Department was about to soon release a report about increasing Soviet involvement in Nicaragua, a report which was called by Mr. Lloyd, part of a continuing effort to persuade Congress that Nicaragua has become a Soviet satellite. And then he said this, While there is no hard evidence to point to what the Soviets' real intentions are in Nicaragua, they might be there to form monasteries, perhaps. Administration officials now believe the Soviet Union is digging in to protect the Nicaraguan regime. What in the world does it mean to say there is no hard evidence as to what Soviet intentions are in Nicaragua? A joint U.S. State Department, Defense Department report, the Soviet-Cuban connection in Central America and the Caribbean, points out that the Soviets have supplied the Sandinistas in Nicaragua with at least 340 tanks and armored vehicles, more than 70 long-range howitzers and rocket launchers, and 30 helicopters, including a half dozen of the world's fastest, best-armed helicopters, the Mi-24 Hind D. In addition, the Soviets have given the Sandinistas, according to this report, more than 1,000 field kitchens, a number of mobile maintenance workshops, and about 75 gasoline tankers, all requirements for an offensive-minded army. Also, several huge construction projects backed by the Soviet bloc represent the investment, says this report, of hundreds of millions of dollars, including $70 million for nearly 40 new military facilities. And finally, Otto Reich, the State Department's coordinator for public diplomacy for Latin America and the Caribbean, says that proportionately, the Soviet military investment in Nicaragua is roughly equal to that in Cuba. In view of all this, is it really possible not to infer any Soviet intentions as regards Nicaragua? Indeed, is this not hard evidence that at the very least the Soviets intend to support the communists who now run Nicaragua? Of course. But not to Mr. Lloyd. In an interview, Mr. Lloyd told me that what you don't have is any captured documents indicating agreements as to the extent of what Soviet intentions are in black and white. You don't know, he said, if the Soviets are playing hardball or softball. I said, really? You mean you don't know? Mr. Lloyd said, nobody knows. Me, well, I know. Can't certain intentions be reasonably inferred from certain actions, such as the Soviets sending the Sandinistas Hind choppers, tanks, 152-millimeter howitzers, surface-to-air missiles? I asked Mr. Lloyd. I mean, these tanks aren't going to be used as planters, are they? Mr. Lloyd said, but there's no definite proof. A rationalist to the core. No definite proof that the Soviets are in Nicaragua for the long haul, or if, and then he breaks off saying, what do we know? Their military commitment so far is not something that indicates the Soviets want to stay in Nicaragua forever. He reiterates that until the administration has something definite, like diplomatic communications or a captured treaty, he didn't say it, I would imagine, or perhaps a Polaroid photograph, indicating arrangements between the Nicaraguans and the Soviets, which I am sure there are many of, he says. Now, this is interesting. He's sure they're there, but since he hasn't seen them, says he doesn't know. Very hard, he says, very difficult to point to exactly what their intentions are. Mr. Reich, incidentally, State Department Coordinator for Public Diplomacy on Latin and Central America, told me there has been such a treaty. He says that in 1980, the Soviet Union signed a treaty of cooperation with the Sandinistas, but Mr. Lloyd seems unaware of this document. Get the feeling that if you showed it to him, he still would say, well, he wasn't there to see them sign it. And if he was there, how could you really be sure it was them? And if it was them, could he be sure that he was there? See, this is a no-win argument. beginning to give a little ground in our conversation. Mr. Lord says, you know, and I know, and probably a lot of people know, that the Soviets would probably like to use Nicaragua as an intelligence depot. It is geopolitically transparent what the Soviets are after. But on the other hand, he says, playing the devil's advocate, he says, one could argue that the Soviets are playing a card. How serious are they? I don't know, he says. How committed are they to Nicaragua? He asks. He says he doesn't think Nicaragua means that much to the Soviets because they've got Cuba. Interesting. Mr. Lloyd thinks the communist appetite is satiable. When I mentioned that Alexander Solzhenitsyn has repeatedly lamented the fact that since 1848 the communists have written thousands of books and articles spelling out their intentions very explicitly, but that very few people have read or believed these writings, Mr. Lloyd says, yeah. And he agrees that the track record of Soviet communism is important. But he says again that there is nothing in black and white. There's that Polaroid picture. That says exactly what the Soviets will expend in Nicaragua in money, political capital, and military resources. Mr. Lloyd says that with the exception of the deadly, sophisticated Hind choppers, what the Soviets are giving the Sandinistas is third-rate military gear, your basic first-level toy package of military weapons. Perhaps that's true if you live in New York, like Mr. Lloyd does. I assure you it is not true if you live in Honduras. And he adds, you can pretty safely assume that the Soviets, if you open a crack anywhere in the world, are going to try to take advantage of it. This man is becoming a fairly staunch anti-communist in the course of our brief conversation. Mr. Lloyd also notes that he thinks the intentions of the Nicaraguan Revolution were clear from the beginning. That it is that those running it were not interested in pluralism. And he points out that in the summer of 1979, he did a story about how the Soviets and Cubans were in Nicaragua. And the Sandinistas, he said, were killing their political opposition and toying with the communists. He said he put this on the air. And I told him this was terrific. But if Robin Lloyd really knew all of this, then it renders his astonishingly idiotic, we don't have the hard evidence of Soviet intentions in Nicaragua report, all the more inexplicable. And his professed knowledge of this subject in no way diminishes his report's considerable value to the forces of tyranny seeking to capture Central America. How much time? About six. People in the press also know who to go after. One person they're going after now is Pat Buchanan. I wouldn't like this even if Pat weren't my friend. But Pat needs your prayers because he's under assault. He needs letters supporting him because the attacks are quite vicious. And the truth is of no relevance whatsoever to those who are his enemies. A recent story in the Washington Post, in his zeal to punish Mr. Buchanan for having committed the terrible act of not returning his phone call, Washington Post reporter Luke Cannon seriously misquoted not only President Reagan, but he attributed to Pat phraseology which was not Pat's. On April 27th, in a front page story that Pat's been on the front page of the Post lately, something he had not really been able to do prior to assuming his new job. It's not publicity he's seeking, however, I can assure you, but April 27th, front page in the Post, under the preposterous headline, Buchanan seen hurting president, Luke Cannon reported, Mr. Buchanan is credited. How's that for a weasel word? He is credited with the president's characterization of World War II German soldiers and SS troops as victims of the Nazis just as surely as the victims in the concentration camps. Just exactly, of course, who credited Mr. Buchanan with this, Mr. Cannon doesn't tell us. Matter of fact, I envision a dialogue that goes something like this. Lou Cannon's at his desk typing away, and he turns to the reporter next to him and said, "Jim, would you credit Pat with that phraseology?" And Jim says, "Why, sure, Lou." Then Lou can just write that Pat's been credited with doing that. That's not dishonest, is it? Oh, maybe a little, but he's on a deadline, you know, deadline pressure. Now, to make a long story short, the point is, when you go back and look at Mr. Reagan's remarks, which is made to a group of journalists, A, Mr. Reagan did not say that the SS troops buried in the Bitburg Cemetery were equal to those who were their victims. He talked about the young Germans, young teenagers, some of whom he said were forced into the service. We've seen those pictures at the end of World War II, the old newsreels of Hitler going down the line, shaking hands with guys, you know, their hats were down to here, and they were very young. This is who the president was talking about. Anybody who read the transcript clearly saw that. But Mr. Cannon lied, and it was a very damaging lie. Not to mention very sloppy journalism. But Pat is doing a good job. He's in there fighting for what's right. He's winning some. He's losing some. But he does need our prayers. He needs our letters, personal letters of support. And I guess I'll have more to say about this afternoon. Thank you very much.
Isn't it exciting and isn't it encouraging to know and see in the live flesh a journalist who is involved in the mass media at the national level? I say praise the Lord for that, don't you?
What sort of restrictions ought to be put on the CIA?
Yeah, and the converse of that, you know, what kind of authority should they be allowed to? Where can they go, and how does that interact?
Do me a favor. Refine your question, and let's get it this afternoon, because it's much too lengthy for him to deal with right now. Do you have a quickie, Mike? Okay.
One quickie.
How do we effectively support people like Pat Buchanan in Washington, who is in touch with the president? How can we effectively support him with our letters?
Question is how to effectively support Pat. It would be basically what I said. I mean, first of all, Pat needs personal support. Obviously, prayer is, to me, the first order of the day. Also, there are personal notes that should be sent to Pat, just saying, "Hey, keep slugging. I know it's heavy going at times, but we're praying for you. And you're in our thoughts, and obviously we want to do anything out here we can do to help you." The final level of help, I think, would just be letters to Reagan. Apropos of nothing in particular, just that we're so glad that Pat's on the staff and that you have this strong support. That's all. Because if you get overly specific, then it looks like some sort of a lobbying campaign on Pat's behalf. And it might be construed by some as Pat having organized something, which of course would be highly unfair to him because he's not. But that's it. Prayers, personal notes to Pat, just saying, "We know you're there and we thank God for you and we're praying for you." And then just general notes to Reagan saying, "We're so glad that you've hired him and hope that, you know, you listen to his counsel."
Tell him that John Lawson was in Atlanta asking for prayers for it. That'd mean a lot to him.
Yeah.
And it would show that Christians everywhere are developing a concern that they should have.